A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Willie, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Nez, Richard, 2, Henry's, 4, 5, 6, then who? Edward's, 4, 5, Dick the Bad, Harry's, Twain, and Ned the Lad, Mary, Bessie, James of Ain, Charlie, Charlie, James again, William and Mary, Anna, Gloria, 4 Georges. We are working our way through the Georges, and we are up to George number 3. George the 3rd, George William Frederick, who was born in 1738 and he died in 1820. So George III takes us into the 19th century. It's all starting to feel quite, well, not exactly recent, but it's coming into the sort of history where I think a lot of people have more of a grasp of where we fit into the history of the last 200 years, much more so than when you go back to the 1300s or the 1400s or something. And you can tell by that that George was pretty old when he died. He was 81 and he ruled from 1760. So he was on the throne for 59 years. And for a long while, he was the record holder in terms of how long he'd lived and how long he'd ruled. He still is the longest lived and longest reigning male monarch. But obviously the likes of Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II have knocked him off the winner's podium in the female events. Now, a lot happened in George III's reign because he lived so long and ruled so long. A lot of history happened while he was on the throne. He wasn't aware of all of it because he did have spells of madness. He's famous for it. Alan Bennett's famous play, The Madness of King George III, which became the film The Madness of King George III, or in America, as we looked at in the last episode, it was just called The Madness of King George, in case people thought it was a sequel. But also, you know, we laugh at the Americans for this. You can see their point also because as far as the Americans are concerned, he is just King George. They don't know, they don't care about any of the other King Georges because it was George who was on the throne at the time of the American Revolution, which became the American War of Independence, which led to the formation of the United States of America. And King George was the great enemy who was characterized by the Americans as this terrible tyrant, although, as we will see, he wasn't particularly. And the events of the American War of Independence are much more interesting and subtle and nuanced than they are often presented by the likes of the Make America Great Again Brigade. So not only did George lose America, he was also on the throne at the time of the French Revolution, which caused shockwaves throughout Europe. Monarchs desperately hanging on to their crowns and super gluing themselves to their thrones in the fear that they would be deposed. But he kept his throne despite being bonkers. He saw the French Revolution flare up and then, well, it didn't fizzle out, but it got hijacked by Napoleon. And so George was a king on the throne throughout the Napoleonic Wars, up to and including Napoleon's final defeat in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo. So as I say, there's a lot of history to get in, because the other thing that happened in 1800 was that the Acts of Union were passed, which officially unified Great Britain and Ireland into the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, which consisted of England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. It becomes an official body, officially run from London. And we remained the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland until Ireland separated into two parts. And our present monarch, Charles III, is king of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. At the same time, George was Duke and Prince Elector of Hanover in the Holy Roman Empire, and then officially became the King of Hanover in 1814, by which point he didn't really know what was going on at all. So, yes, because we have so much to try and fit in, I'm going to split George into two halves. This episode will take us up to the outbreak of the French Revolution, although I might look a little bit ahead with my guest James Hawes to the Act of Union. But anyway, so George III. He was the first of the Hanoverian kings to be born in Great Britain. He was the first who spoke English as his first language. And as a matter of fact, he never actually visited Hanover. He was interested in what was going on there, but he didn't seem to be interested enough to actually go there. He didn't seem to like travel at all. He never went to the north of England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland. He stayed pretty much in the south of England. And he used to take his holidays at the seaside, at Weymouth in Dorset, which he popularised as one of the first seaside resorts in England. And it became a fashionable thing to go to the seaside, which is why you have a lot of these Georgian and later Regency buildings in many of our seaside towns, like famously Brighton. The Regency, which we will come to in the second episode about George, basically refers to the period of time where George was so out of it that his son, also obviously called George, basically ruled in his place as a prince regent. And as with all the other King Georges, George hated his son George, and his son George hated his father. So their relationship was quite controversial, and the regency was quite controversial. Actually, on that front, when I'm researching this series, I look into as many sort of popular histories as I can, just to try and get an angle on each monarch. And there's quite an amusing one called The Story of Britain by Patrick Dillon. It was published as recently as 2010, but there does seem something slightly old-fashioned about it. Dillon is trying to fit in the whole of British history and make it clear and understandable for a child, which is tricky when you're dealing with often very adult human emotions and behaviour. So I'd just like to read a bit, because I was reading about it the other day and it did amuse me. This is how Dillon characterises George III's son, George, the Prince Regent, the Prince of Wales, who becomes George IV. He says, "The king's son was a fat boy, also called George, who spent his time on clothes, horses and pretty girls, who only liked him because he was a prince." Which I think he says quite a lot there. I'm not sure in a modern history book for children you'd be allowed to use the word fat. So apologies to any children listening. He goes on to say that the younger George didn't get on with his father and, to annoy him, had made friends with Charles Fox, the politician who criticised the king the most. So it's interesting, the mention of Charles Fox there. And Dillon has neatly summed up King George's relationship with Charles Fox, and indeed with a lot of the politicians. Now, as ever, I'm going to try not to get caught up in the political side of things, in this churn of influential politicians, who is important and in favour at any one time. As we will see, when George came to the throne, he gave a sort of last gasp attempt to be a proper monarch, to be a proper old-fashioned king, to rule the country, to control Parliament and not be dictated to by them. He failed fairly quickly, and, well, he learnt to deal with politicians better. He also learnt that he was a constitutional monarch, not an absolute monarch. By constitutional monarch, I mean a monarch who has to follow a set of rules laid down by Parliament. He can only do what Parliament lets him do. And by the end of George's reign, he very much has accepted that the position of king has become almost ceremonial. He is a figurehead. He has very little to do with running the country, particularly as for a large part of his later reign, he was too manic and mad to even run his own household, let alone a country. And we see through George's reign these various politicians rise, fail, fall, rise again. You've probably heard of William Pitt the Elder, and he pretty much took over from Robert Walpole as being the most influential minister, as being the prime minister. And he straddled the reigns of King George II and King George III. And both the king and the people of Britain had a sort of ambivalent attitude towards William Pitt. They liked him when he helped them win wars and when he sorted out the country and got things going. But then they feared that he was getting too powerful, that he was becoming like a sort of king in his own right. So they would try and undermine him, and then he would throw a fit and he would resign, and various other people would take over and come and go. King George got very pally with one of his tutors, his governors, when he was growing up, this man Bute, and liked him so much and respected his opinion so much that he manoeuvred Bute into the sort of prime position in politics. But this didn't go down well with other politicians. They didn't like the king interfering, and Bute was not a particularly good politician. After Bute comes this man, Lord North, who is one of those politicians who's perfectly adequate in peacetime, but once we get into wartime, is not the right man for the job. And people are clamouring for William Pitt to come back. Eventually, William Pitt the Elder dies during George III's reign. And interestingly, his son, who becomes known as William Pitt the Younger, is urged to fill his boots. And at the age of only 24, William Pitt the Younger becomes a big man in politics. Now, I'm doing this all up front to kind of get it out the way, because I'm not going to try and follow the ins and outs of this through these two episodes. So George, as I say, spoke English as his first language. And at his accession speech in 1760, when he was crowned, he made a point of saying, "I was born and educated in this country. I glory in the name of Britain." He was smart enough to see that the British were still ambivalent about these German kings, these Hanoverians coming over. And each new one is trying to say, "I'm even more English than the last." And it's interesting that he did say English there and not British, because, as I say, he never left England all his life. So, as I say, during his reign, the power of the king diminished even further. And George had to accept that he would never be an absolute monarch. But one thing he did do is that he started to heavily promote this idea that monarchs should behave in a certain way, that they should be regal, that they should be moral and pious and very well behaved. This idea that the king should set an example to the people. And he was very dismissive of other members of his family who didn't live up to his high standards, who didn't follow his ideals. I mean, a lot of his family, his brothers and sisters, his own children, did behave in a pretty, you could say, medieval manner in some of their personal relationships and misbehaviour. And George was forever ticking them off and looking down his nose at them. One commentator at the time, Lord Waldegrave, said, "His religion is not of the most charitable sort. He has rather too much attention to the sins of his neighbour." And George was always complaining that it was his misfortune to live in particularly wicked times, although they didn't seem to have been any more wicked than any other times, but they were the times he was living in. So they were the only times he knew. As I say, he was very devout. He spent hours in prayer, probably praying to God to save his badly behaved brothers with their loose morals. They were always committing adultery and marrying the wrong people. George himself never took a mistress, in stark contrast with his grandfather, his father, his brothers and his sons. And he enjoyed a pretty happy marriage until his mental illness derailed everything. So that idea that the monarch should be this paragon of virtue is something that kind of stuck. And we see how Queen Victoria really sort of promotes this idea. And it's an idea that persists to the present day, upheld by the likes of the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph and the more conservative Tory newspapers, who were always tutting at the members of the royal family who don't behave in an appropriate manner for a royal. And as I say, this whole thing was an invention of George III's. You look at the behaviour of the royals before him, we're all over the bloody place. So George had a fairly conventional upbringing. He was not a particularly bright child. He was accused of laziness and occasional melancholy, or of being miserable, sullen and silent and distant and quite shy, actually. So people didn't warm to him as a child. He had some very boring tutors, which can't have helped. The one thing he did have that was fairly new was that he had a proper scientific education. And he did become interested in science, particularly astronomy. He was involved in setting up the Royal Astronomy in Greenwich. He had his own telescope and was always dragging people in to look through it at the procession of Venus. But he seemed to have been sort of inoffensive, I suppose. And some people saw him a bit differently. The Duchess of Northumberland said when he was a young man that he was in his person tall and robust, more graceful than genteel, with an unparalleled air of majestic dignity. There was a noble openness in his countenance, blended with a cheerful, good-natured affability. He was fair and fresh-coloured, and had now and then a few pimples out. His eyes were blue, his teeth extremely fine, his hair a light auburn, his voice was strong, melodious, and clear. So this slightly dull, sullen child did seem to have blossomed a bit as he grew up. But his life took an unexpected turn in 1751 when his father died from some kind of lung injury. If you remember, some people have claimed he was hit by a cricket ball or a tennis ball, and others that he had pulmonary embolism. But anyway, his father, Frederick, Prince of Wales, was out of the picture, which meant that young George becomes next in line to the throne. He was made the Duke of Edinburgh, and his grandfather, George II, began to take a bit of an interest in him, because George II had hated his son Frederick, Prince of Wales, and had really been quite pleased when he died. But now King George II had direct access to his grandson and could think about steering him in the way that he wanted. But in 1760, George II himself died, and George III came to the throne at the age of 22, at which point it was decided he really ought to get married. George, in line with this idea to sort of promote his Englishness, initially said perhaps he should marry some kind of English noblewoman, but no, it was considered that he should make a political marriage with a foreign princess. And eventually they settled on Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, who was 17 at the time. And as one historian puts it, three separate reports denied her beauty, but she was reputed sensible, and although a Lutheran, had no objection to the Anglican creed. So she wasn't a great looker, but she was okay and wouldn't cause any problems, which pretty much summed up her life. She did very little. She had no interest in politics. She was considered a safe bet, and so she was. Now, in the 20th century, some historians started to promote the idea that Queen Charlotte had African ancestry, and that the shape of her nose and lips in one portrait showed her to have, as they saw it, non-European features. And this is the idea that they have a lot of fun with in Bridgerton and the spin-off series Queen Charlotte, where Charlotte is played by mixed race actresses. And, you know, I mean, this is a cool and an interesting way of looking at history and helps us to kind of rethink, reconsider the past. But I'm not sure it's intended to be taken literally. I mean, the idea is that one of Queen Charlotte's distant ancestors, King Alfonso III of Portugal, way back in the 13th century, 500 years previously, had a mistress who was possibly Moorish, who Charlotte was descended from. Now, 15 generations later, any kind of African genes are going to be so diluted as to be non-existent. It would be like a homeopathic dose. And why was it only Charlotte and no one else in her family who displayed these so-called African characteristics? Funnily enough, one of my sons did one of those DNA tests and it said that he was a small part Nigerian, which he's very proud of. But, you know, me and my wife have done these tests. I think we got them as birthday presents from someone. And nothing like that shows up in ours. And, you know, genetics works in a funny way. And we are all in a crazy mixed up melting pot. And certainly in none of the paintings of Charlotte is her skin depicted as anything other than a ghostly pale white. And George never actually met her until the day that he married her, in September 1761. They met at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, were married at 9 o'clock at night. A lot of these marriages seem to happen in the evenings, I think possibly because then they were expected to go straight to bed and start trying to produce children. I'm not sure Charlotte was particularly fond of George at first. It must have all been a bit of a shock to her, really, but she did grow close to him. Close enough to have 15 children. So George and Charlotte had a joint coronation in Westminster Abbey a fortnight after getting married. Imagine what that must have been like for a 17-year-old girl. Yes, she's been brought up in a royal palace. I mean, Mecklenburg-Strelitz is one of these little duchies, these principalities within Germany. But she would have had an aristocratic upbringing. She would know a bit about what court life is like. But to suddenly, at the age of 17, be thrown into this marriage with someone you don't know and then crowned Queen of England alongside him, must have been pretty bewildering. Now, as I said earlier, one of the first things George did on becoming king was to install his old tutor, his governor, John Stuart, the Earl of Bute, as Prime Minister, which was not popular, particularly as Bute was Scottish. There were mumblings that George was trying to act like a Scottish king, like a Stuart, that he was trying to be all-powerful. And a lot of scurrilous, untrue gossip went around that Bute had been having an affair with George's widowed mother. He was hanged in effigy and assaulted in the streets. Now, at the time of recording this, there's a lot of controversy going on. The Conservative government is trying to bring in pretty heavy-handed laws to try and protect politicians, saying they mustn't be abused, as if this is a new thing that's never happened before. But I think our present-day politicians have it pretty easy compared to politicians in the Hanoverian period. So Bute didn't last long, and George was a bit scalded in his dealings with government. One thing that went in his favour, it was that fairly early in his reign, England defeated France in the Seven Years' War. Now, I'm going to look at the Seven Years' War in a separate episode because it was such an important moment in European history and I don't really have the time to get into it here. But it did mean that England ended up as the dominant European power in North America and India. What we sometimes forget is that France had had a big presence in India, but the British East India Company had formed its own army and had been fighting the French. But with the Seven Years' War over, a lot of trade opened up for Britain, which started to fill the coffers. And also because we weren't having to pay for a war, things were going much better economically. So George settles down to married life. He buys Buckingham House, mainly as a larger, more comfortable London residence for Charlotte. He calls it the Queen's House. It is now called Buckingham Palace, although it is not exactly the same building as it was then. It was heavily added to. There were three wings added to it making it a huge square with this great big internal courtyard. Now, funnily enough, at the time of recording this, I was at Buckingham Palace only a few days ago. I've been there on a few occasions for various functions. And my most recent visit, I was there as one of the judges of a children's writing prize. And Queen Camilla is a patron of this competition, 500 words it is called. And the award ceremony was held at the palace, which was a lot of fun. So here am I, the host of this podcast, starting to enter the story myself. I have to say that whenever I visit Buckingham Palace, I always leave with a feeling that I really wouldn't want to live there. It has got these huge, quite characterless state rooms everywhere. Now, they are state rooms. I know that the royal family have their own more homely apartments in the palace. But all these big ceremonial rooms seem sort of quite heavy and stuffy. But the interesting thing is that each time I visit, I know more about the monarchs depicted in the various portraits hanging on the walls. But I digress. So George, when he came to the throne, the crown property, the crown lands, didn't actually produce that much income. So the monarchs were fairly reliant on taxes. But George surrendered the crown estate to Parliament in return for a civil list. So this is an official figure given by government to the royal family every year so they can run their household and cover their expenses. But George, during the course of his long reign, still managed to amass over £3 million in debt that was paid by Parliament, but they did have to keep increasing the civil list. George didn't spend all that money on himself by any means. He helped the Royal Academy of Arts with large grants. He gave a lot to charity, and he was a patron and supporter of various scientific institutions. He did collect art, most notably a set of Canalettos and Vermeer's Lady at the Virginals. And funnily enough, sorry, here's another anecdote. Funnily enough, when I was at the palace the other day, part of the event was a reception held in one of the galleries there, and I had a good look at Lady at the Virginals. It is amazing to actually see these paintings in the flesh, as it were, rather than as reproductions in books or on the internet. So it's always good to see the actual paintings themselves. And you may say, oh, yes, Charlie, but I can't just stroll into Buckingham Palace and look at these paintings. No, you can't, but you can stroll into the National Gallery. It's still free and it is full of the most amazing art. So go in there and look at some paintings, or go around the corner to the National Portrait Gallery and look at the paintings of all these kings and queens I've been talking about and the various other famous men and women who were around during their reigns. But George is best known as a collector of books, and the King's Library became the foundation of a new national library. So as I say, early in George's reign, 1763, the Seven Years' War ended. The Peace of Paris, which concluded the war, it was considered, well, that it didn't really benefit England as much as it might, although we did definitely come out of it better than the French. They gave us the whole of Canada and a vast swathe of land in what is now the United States. The English had the sort of strip down the East Coast, New England, Connecticut, down to Philadelphia. And before the Seven Years' War, France had owned the sort of next strip over. But that was also given to Britain. And my starting point in making this series was the basic fact that one thing leads to another. In this series, one monarch leads to another, but one part of history is linked. There's a series of links. Everything that happens has consequences. And the consequences of the Seven Years' War were massive. Britain becomes the dominant power in India. And within a very short time, the British are ruling India. France has been economically crippled by this war and by the treaty that ended it, a bit like the Germans at the end of the First World War. In the same way that Germany struggled economically after the war, which led to radicalism, that led to extremism, that led to the rise of Hitler and the Nazis after the Seven Years' War, France struggled economically, which led to radicalism, which led to the French Revolution And again, the rise of extremism and a dictator taking charge in the form of Napoleon. And it's interesting that all of these populist revolutions start off by saying we should have no despotic rulers. There should be equality, liberty and freedom for all. And they very quickly descend into chaos, which leads to one powerful man taking control. In the French Revolution, we see ultimately it's Napoleon. The Russian Revolution, it becomes Lenin and then Stalin. In China, we get Chairman Mao, etc., etc. It seems that we cannot legislate for human nature. But also, the Seven Years' War pretty much leads towards the American War of Independence. Now, first of all, what happens is that this war has been expensive not only for the French, but also for the British. And in order to claw back some money, the British are understandably taxing all of their colonists around the world. So there's money coming in from India, there's money coming in from Africa, there's money coming in from Ireland, there's money coming in from the American colonists, who are essentially English. Now, the British army has been out there fighting alongside the English colonists in America. They've been fighting the French. They have now beaten the French. They now have access to this large area of land to the west. But the British government put limits on it. They say that there are limits to how much land these colonists can take. The British have made treaties and alliances with the local population, the Native Americans, who have helped them in the war against the French. And they have officially mapped out lands owned by the original Americans. There is also a very valuable fur trade with these people that the British don't want to disrupt. And in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, government does place a limit on the westward expansion of the American colonies and create the first proper Indian reserves. Now, the locals out there don't like this. They're saying, we live here, we'll decide if we want to go and take some land from over there. So this leads to a pretty vocal minority getting up in arms against the British government and King George. And they also don't like paying taxes, even though everyone else in the British Empire is paying taxes, some of them a lot more than these American settlers are. But they say, and they have a good point, we are not going to pay taxes if we don't have any direct representation. They're saying there are no American seats in Parliament, yet you're imposing taxes on us. You're imposing laws and rules on us. We don't like this. And the British government is saying, well, we supported you in the war against the French. We saved your bacon. We paid for all that. It was pretty bloody expensive. The least you can do is give us some money towards it. And actually, one young English officer who came to prominence during the war against the French in America was a guy called George Washington. But, you know, maybe having fought in this war, it gave the local English colonists, maybe gave them some ideas, gave them the idea that these large, powerful forces can be beaten. And then things were made worse in 1765 when the British introduced the Stamp Act, which raised stamp duty on every document signed in the British colonies in North America. Again, this was throughout the empire. As it turned out, newspapers were printed on stamped paper. And so this stamp duty idea backfired massively because the newspapers were the most effective propaganda for opposing the tax. So the British government is falling apart a bit, trying to deal with all this. And William Pitt the Elder kind of comes riding back into town and takes over, tries to sort things out on the condition that he's created the Earl of Chatham. He repeals the Stamp Act with the support of George III. And the two of them become so popular in America that statues of them both were erected in New York City. Not long after, when the war with America broke out, they were pulled down. So the other thing that was unpopular is the various custom duties imposed on the Americans. This is simply for the government to make money out of the trade that's going on. And the custom duties were withdrawn from everything except tea. And George said he wanted to keep it in place because it maintained a foothold. It set a precedent for the fact that they could set duty and raise taxes. They couldn't just get rid of everything. But in 1773, the tea ships that were moored in Boston Harbour were boarded by a group of colonists and smugglers dressed as Native Americans, and they threw all the tea overboard. This became known as the Boston Tea Party. Now, the British government could have reacted in two ways. They could have thrown a fit and said, this is criminal, this is terrible, we're going to close the harbour down, we're going to try and arrest these people. Or they could have said, all right, look, we've got a problem here. Why don't we look into giving these people representation in the British Parliament? And you know what? I'm not sure why they didn't do that. So I'm going to ask my guests if they can enlighten me on that one. But no, they took the heavy-handed approach, and this just made things worse. I mean, I've said over and over again through this series, you can't run countries without raising taxes, but people don't like to pay taxes. And the Americans particularly hate to pay taxes, certain type of American anyway. And so they characterised George as a tyrant. But in fact, he wasn't. He was acting alongside his ministers. He was trying to help the Americans when he could. But it helped their cause to portray him as this despot, this monster. And it leads to some battles between rebel Americans and loyalist Americans. Now, I'm calling them Americans because, well, I mean, they were Americans, but they're essentially English. These are all English people. So we have a war breaking out amongst English colonists who are living in America. Some of them are loyal to the British Crown, a lot more than contemporary Americans always give them credit. But a lot of them were rebels, including the Englishman George Washington. There were initial skirmishes, which became battles. There was one at Lexington and one at Concord. So George has to send navy and an army from Britain to try and help the loyalists and to try and preserve the colonies. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. So essentially, we have the American rebels who are English. We have the American loyalists who are English. And we have the British army, which is predominantly Scots and Irish. So we really have the English fighting against the Scots and Irish, the English on the American side. George even recruited an army from Hanover and sent them over. So now we have the English Americans fighting Scots, Irish and Germans. And the English Americans then make a treaty with the French to bring them into the war on their side. And the French drag the Spanish along with them. So now we have the so-called American army, which is made up of English, French and Spanish, against the so-called English army, which is made up of a few English, but mostly Scots, Irish, Germans, and also some Native Americans who are fighting for the British because they're trying to preserve their land against the expansion of the American colonies. So it's a much more complex situation than is perhaps depicted in certain gung-ho American films and TV series. It is only later on that these aspects of sort of idealism creep into it. And a lot of this is kind of retrospectively added to make these founding fathers of America seem like they had been fighting for certain principles. Principles of liberty and republicanism, that they are concerned with higher ideals, that all along their plan had been to create this great democracy, which wasn't really the initial impetus for rebellion. And the interesting thing is that most British people know next to nothing about the American War of Independence, and they don't really care about it. They don't know about any of these battles and what happened and who the generals were. They may have heard of Paul Revere, but they don't really know who he was or what he did. They might have heard of the Minutemen, who are the sort of local militia who can supposedly be ready for action to fight the British in less than a minute. And this is the whole birth, the origins of the idea that Americans should be allowed to own guns and to use them freely. It goes right back to this period where the gun is seen as a symbol of resistance against the tyrannical British reign and the amendment to the American Constitution is really to allow these militia men to own these guns, to be able to fight off the British Army, or if the American government itself becomes despotic, it means that the people have the right to take up arms against the government. I don't think they envisage the full consequences of this amendment being willfully misunderstood to mean that everybody should be allowed to just carry a gun willy-nilly in the glove box of their car and shoot people when they feel like it. But yes, the American War of Independence is largely a mystery to the British people. Not a period of history we get particularly worked up about. I mean, it's obviously completely understandable why it's so important to the Americans. This is the founding of the United States of America. The historian Simon Jenkins has described the formation of the United States of America as Britain's greatest creation. George stubbornly refused to give in to the Americans, even though it was virtually impossible to sustain a major war on the other side of the Atlantic. The logistics were too great. The cost was just too great. And when it was clear that the rebels were more powerful and committed than the loyalists, Parliament and the people started saying, you've got to pull out, let them go. It doesn't matter. There was unrest on the streets. It led to some riots called the Gordon Riots, which were essentially anti-Catholic. But they also happened at a time when people feel that the government's losing control, that things are slipping out of control. People can often take to the streets. In 1776, the Americans declared themselves independent, and the British finally admitted defeat in 1780. And the loss of America was humiliating, but there were advantages to it. Britain made a pretty swift economic and financial recovery because they weren't having to spend all this huge amount of money on it. And the disappearance of the American problem meant that British politics could settle down without constantly arguing about all this. So it wasn't perhaps the devastating blow to Britain that some people have claimed. But the English rebels in America are now free of British rule and they can set about creating a new country. A process which, as I said, started in 1776 when the rebel leaders all got together and made their Declaration of Independence. And if some of this sounds a bit like Star Wars, that is not coincidental. The myths of the American War of Independence permeate a huge amount of American thinking and American culture. The Empire in Star Wars is the British Empire, the villains all played by English actors. The plucky homespun rebels are played by American actors. And you know, and why do so many American historical epics have those long, dull scenes set in the Roman Senate? It's because American Parliament was set up along Roman lines, and the Republicans in the Roman Senate in those films are trying to resist the rise of another emperor. But it all starts with the Declaration of Independence, which was largely written by Thomas Jefferson, and it was published on, yes, it's one of the dates we know, the 4th of July. It declared George III to be unfit to be the ruler of free people. And perhaps its best known passage reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And what they didn't add in brackets was, "unless you are a Native American or a slave." And I think nearly all of these men who signed the Declaration of Independence were slave owners, and they were all pretty intent on pushing west and ignoring any rights that the original Americans had. So King George III was having to contend with all of this, was having to deal with Parliament, deal with the American problem, deal with the war. It didn't help that two of his sons died in infancy in 1782, in 1783, and George was very, very fond of his children. He was very much a family man. And he said of one of his boys, "There will be no heaven for me if Octavius is not there." And it was around this time that George's health was starting to deteriorate, his mental health. Now, people have argued over the years about what this was. Originally, because mental health was not well understood, it was always put down to shock or stress, and it was characterised that the shock of losing the American colonies threw him into madness. Certainly, stress can be a big factor. For a long while, the medical diagnosis of porphyria was most commonly accepted. This is a blood disease. I think it's a kidney disease. One of the symptoms is that it turns your urine purple. And there were reports that George's urine was purple. But it seems that the most common diagnosis these days is bipolar disorder, which manifests itself in many different ways. It used to be called manic depression, and certainly a key part of it is these swings, which can be, you know, it can sort of oscillate through one day, or it can be over the course of a year, you might be in one state, depending on the type of bipolar disorder you have. But you can be plunged into terrible despair, or you can be lifted to the heights of incredible mania, where you are sort of filled with a sort of, you feel yourself to be a sort of godlike figure, filled with this incredible energy and insight, and you can't stop talking and you use all this flowery language and become obsessed by things. If you want to see what this behavior can look like, have a look at some of Russell Brand's more out there videos on YouTube. And certainly George did suffer from mania. He would talk for hours on end until he was foaming at the mouth and his voice was hoarse and cracked. He would get these wild flights of fancy. And then he would be plunged into despair, saying, I'm going mad. What's happening to me? I'm losing everything. This is a disaster. Doctors didn't know how to deal with it. They tried putting him in a straitjacket until he'd calmed down. And they tried putting these caustic poultices on him and cupping them to try and draw out this evil from within him, which, of course, would have done nothing beneficial and only exacerbated his unbalanced mental state. But this first attack of mania, whatever you want to call it, madness, was not as extreme as it was in later years. But he did leave London to go to Cheltenham Spa and visited various other places in an attempt to find some kind of a cure. And this was the first time that the regency was put into effect. His son, George, who we will look at in more detail in the next episode, is offered the reins while his father is indisposed. But George does make a recovery, and he does recover his popularity alongside William Pitt the Elder, and at the expense of the politician Charles Fox, who you mentioned in the quote earlier, and the Prince of Wales. He gained even more popularity when there was an assassination attempt on him when he was at the theatre in Drury Lane. There was this guy called Hadfield, who was an officer who'd been very badly injured at the Battle of Tourcoing. And he was hit around the head, I think, 8 times with a French sabre. And he was heavily scarred for the rest of his life. And it does seem to have affected his mental health. He got heavily into conspiracy theories and millennialist cults and became convinced that the second coming of Jesus Christ could only happen if he was killed by the English government. So he planned this sort of suicide mission where he would kill the king and then either get shot himself or be captured and executed, which is what all these ghastly shooters seem to want in America. And there was quite a famous case, actually, about whether he was insane, because if he was insane, he couldn't be executed. Hadfield's lawyer in this case did manage to argue for it, and he got the law changed as to what the definition of insanity as a defence in a murder case was. Sorry, I've gone off on a tangent there, but this incident really increased George's stature. Now, if you've been following every episode in this series and that passage sounds familiar, it's because I originally mistakenly put it into the episode about George II, because he also survived an assassination attempt at the theatre. And when I looked it up, I got my Georges confused. But I've removed that passage from the previous episode and put it in here where it belongs. But yes, as I said before, surviving an assassination is one of the best methods for a monarch to increase their popularity. But George's humane treatment of Hadfield, and also a woman called Margaret Nicholson, who also tried to attack him on a different occasion. But George was very understanding towards them. So as I say, he didn't want Hadfield executed. And this made him very popular with the people. He'd come back from his madness and things were restored. In fact, George seemed so nonchalant about the incident that he actually fell asleep in the interval of the play. So things are looking good for George. Things are back on track. And then in 1789, the French decide to have a revolution. And we'll pick up with that in the next episode. But stick with me and come back after the break, where I will be having a general chat about the Georgians with the brilliant James Hawes.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back, and welcome back to James Hawes, who has been a guest on this podcast two or three times before. James is that marvellous thing, more of a generalist when it comes to history. So I can call on you, James, to talk about almost anything.
I'll do it.
But what is germane to George III and the Hanoverians is that you wrote The Shortest History of Germany, and of course the Hanoverians are German. You also wrote The Shortest History of England, and of course they are half German, half English. I mean, what do we call them?
Well, they were known hostilely as Germans for the first two Georges, particularly the first one. I mean, there were widespread riots, particularly in the west and north of England, against him because he was, as the Scots called him, the wee, wee German Lerde, and not a proper king. So they were clearly German, and they were not perceived at all as English, whereas George III was the first of them to actually be born in England.
And yeah, and he never left England.
No, and
he found that extraordinary.
Various things which seemed extraordinary English to us in retrospect. George III's father, who would have been, should have been, so was king, he was Prince of Wales, Frederick, and was terrifically English. He actually, he was a great cricketer. He was the first person to award money prizes for a cricket match. And was a great proponent of the Royal Navy. Rule Britannia was actually first composed not as a national anthem, but as a kind of party political thing. Because, and this is something which is really important, we're just coming to the birth of modern politics, starting. And this group called the Prince of Wales's Friends did not like his father's policy of intervening to save Hanover. They preferred the idea of going like Drake and Hawkins out, buccaneering away, founding colonies across the other side of the world. So Rule Britannia, Britannia Rules the Waves, was actually a kind of propaganda song for this just coming together political party known as the Prince of Wales's Friends.
Right. And I mean, I gather that one of the main successes of the British Royal Navy, which did become the most dominant and successful navy at the time, was that it was organised not that you would get the job of admiral just because you were posh and had a title, but there was sort of promotion through merit.
Yes, uniquely so in the Europe of the day. It really was. It was enormously well funded by Parliament, and it was in its day the biggest kind of technological military complex on earth. Actually, it funded things like trying to find a way to calculate longitude, voyages to observe the transit of Venus, all in the service of greater naval efficiency. But we're also building blocks of science, the science of gunnery, for example, metallurgy. It was a driver of all of those things, and just before George III arrived, and I think this is really interesting, he arrives at a really kind of, well, a good time to arrive as a new king, frankly, because following Admiral Byng's famous execution in 1757 for not being aggressive enough in combat, essentially, having had an admiral shot on his own quarter, a very well-connected admiral too, shot on his own quarterdeck, it made it pretty obvious to all junior officers in the Navy that you had to attack, attack, attack. And this was the beginning of the Royal Navy's unique cult of all-out attack that would culminate, in, of course, in Nelson and his band of brothers, you know, go straight at him, never mind maneuvers, all that sort of thing. And so this combination of really a career uniquely open to educated middle-class people, or the lower gentry, at least, let's say, because, you know, you had a really strict scientific examination to become a lieutenant. Right. You could not get there by influence. And so you had this combination of really gung-ho young sons of the gentry who are never going to inherit in anything, so they might as well die or make captain, driven by this unique discipline code of all-out assault and great funding. That's what turned the British Navy into the invincible machine it became. And this was just coming together as George appeared in 1760.
Yes, and he very much promoted himself as an Englishman.
Yes, and he took a very sort of public interest in English agriculture.
Was it his nickname, Farmer George?
Yeah, Farmer George, absolutely. I mean, he would actually, when he went on holiday to Weymouth, where my mother lives, I just come back from there actually, which he single-handedly made into a seaside resort by going to take the waters. I mean, he would chat to people merrily about their sort of market price of their cattle or their recipes for apple puddings, apparently quite genuinely. And he became, and this kind of sense of him being normal, it kind of spread virally throughout the country. When one person spoke to another and said, he's a really nice regular bloke, that king. You know, and so he actually, by the end of his reign, he was deeply beloved in a way that none of the previous Hanoverians had been at all. So in that sense, he contributed greatly to the stability of the institution of the monarchy.
And this epithet, Farmer George, I mean, did that start out as an insult, but then sort of slowly turn around to being a bit of a compliment?
Yes, I think at first he was like, God, look, a bit of a bumpkin, this king. But then actually, better to have a nice bumpkin than some evil autocrat, which is how he was considered at other times. Because, I mean, the other side of him is that he was widely perceived here in America particularly, and on the continent, as someone who was really trying to roll back that sort of particularly English parliamentary constitutional mode of things.
Well, it seemed to me like he started off trying to do that and then began to realise that that really was not possible. The tide had turned. He was never going to bring that back. And did he not allow Parliament a greater reign, or was it just a byproduct of him going mad and completely losing control?
I think probably the latter, actually, because right. After he did come back to full sanity briefly, I mean, in one of the greatest issues of these islands, the union with Ireland, where Pitt the Younger and co. had actually, you know, pretty well point blank promised the Irish Parliament that if they enacted the Act of Union, there would be Catholic emancipation. George point blank refused to sign off on this. Not only that, but after Pitt resigned and there was pretty well chaos for 3 or 4 years, as this was all being discussed, he only accepted the return of Pitt and co. if they actually wrote signed declarations in writing that they would never raise the issue of Catholic emancipation with him ever again.
I mean, I haven't actually quite come to that point in this episode, but we will be coming to it. And while we've got you here, there is no harm in talking about it. So what year does that happen? The
1801.
1801. So the start of the new century.
Yeah, exactly.
I had always assumed, you know, because we had been pretty much in control of Ireland for a long time. So what was made different in the Act of Union?
It's quite a strange event. After the total crushing of the native Irish and the English Catholics in Ireland by Cromwell, slowly they were mounting a comeback. And in the second half of the 18th century, it was becoming quite clear that the so-called Protestant ascendancy in Ireland, who were populating Ireland with Georgian architecture and so forth, just like in Britain, were coming to recognise, A, that they were getting interested in the Irish past and helping to find and preserve the ancient records, but they were starting to tolerate their Catholic neighbours among the gentry more and more. I'm starting to see less and less reason why they should maintain this kind of state of a mental siege of being a colonial minority. So by the 1780s, the Dublin Parliament actually gets back the powers it had lost in 1494, to actually have its own legislation and not just rubber stamp Westminster.
So there is an actual Irish Parliament.
There's an Irish Parliament under Grattan, who was a member of the Protestant ascendancy, but keen to give the Catholics emancipation, of course. But this is clamped down by George III's government. And it's all clamped down to such an extent that the Irish then have a rebellion. Mm. And it's the Irish Rebellion of 1798, which has led to the formation of the United Kingdom. I think that's something really important for all of us on these islands to remember, that we have this thing called the UK simply to control Ireland. That was its only version, the only reason it exists. Before that, it was Great Britain. You know, the UK was founded to control Ireland, end of, you know.
So before this point, had English kings considered themselves kings of Ireland?
Yes. Henry VIII was the first person to be named so. They'd been considered the Lords of Ireland before that. He was the first person to call himself King of Ireland. So you had a situation.
King of Ireland, but the British Parliament was not running Ireland.
It was, but the Irish were clawing back power, essentially.
Right.
In the later 18th century. And this all happens under the watch of George III. And as with America, he, or at least the ministers who he tolerated and appointed, they reacted to this kind of bid for, well, in the Irish case, a bid for home rule. In the American case, initially, a bid for, you know, just representation with taxation. Neither the Irish or the Americans originally wanted to have a kind of great full-on rebellion. Mm. And really, it was the intransigence of the governments under George III which led to this.
So the big question I have here, James, is did George consider allowing the Americans to have representation in Parliament? It seemed that would have just solved the problem quite quickly. Say, all right, yeah, you can get some seats in Parliament. Was that ever considered?
I mean, it was considered, and it was actually supported by a number of people in England. That's, again, something we often forget about the American War of Independence. Lots of big names in England, such as John Wilkes. Wilkes and Liberty was the battle cry of the London rioters. Absolutely supported them. And Dr. Johnson didn't, notoriously. But the English society was very much split on it, rather like American society over Vietnam. There were lots and lots of people who listened to people like Adams and Jefferson, who were obsessed, both of them, with the Anglo-Saxons. And you know, Jefferson had all about the Anglo-Saxon liberty. He said things like, William the Conqueror never took America. You know, they were presenting themselves and were seen by some people in London. You know, Benjamin Franklin was going backwards and forwards to London at an incredible rate in the 1760s.
As the true English.
Absolutely. And they see that, and that's why they were supporting exactly that, Charlie, because they saw, and some people in England saw, George III as trying to roll back to a more kind of European style monarchy, which they blamed on his Hanoverianness.
Right.
So he was trying to betray the true Englishness and get kind of more like an autocratic monarchy again, back to the days of, say, James II, if not before. This was somehow un-English and unliberal and un-Whig particularly.
So what would have been the downside for the British Parliament and for King George to allow them representation?
Quite simply, loss of power. It's the same issue you get again and again when faced with, you know, why did the British Crown cling on so long to weird little places like Aden? And I'm old enough to remember that, just about. Loss of power, loss of prestige. The king saw himself as the top of a pyramid that was not going to be kind of gnawed away at the bottom by yielding to goddamn farmers, who they just saw them as a bunch of farmers in America.
So they didn't take the threat of separation seriously enough?
They didn't. They assumed that if it came to a fight, they would win it easily, assuming that people like George Washington would be on their side, as, of course, Washington had fought for the British against the French. They had no idea of the depth of feeling that was going on there. Precisely because they weren't allowing representation, so there was no one to speak for them in Parliament. People like Lord North were able to convince themselves, really, that this was just a bunch of troublesome kind of country guys who, when it came to it, would be quelled by a few volleys of a musketry in Boston and so forth.
What was different in Canada? How come the British seemed to fairly easily keep hold of Canada?
Largely because of the big influx of loyalists from America. A lot of Americans were not in favour of a republic. And they shifted, emigrated, or kicked out in some cases, indeed, to Canada, where they kind of bullheadedly maintain their link to the crown to separate themselves. You know, Canadians love the link to the crown because it's the thing that separates them from Americans. You know, otherwise, they'd just be another bunch of Yanks, but without guns and with healthcare. You know.
They hate the English slightly less than they hate the Americans.
Yes. Because of the presence of the French, of course, the presence of the French minority in Canada, which everyone knew was there. They might not have liked it, but it was there. So it was clearly not possible to try and pretend that this was just part of England. That's the mistake. The mistake that the English made in the 18th century in both America and Ireland was to maintain this weird fiction that you could run it as though it was just a gigantic shire of England. You know, Ireland's a gigantic kind of not very fertile bit of northern England, and America is like a gigantic Somerset, and you can maintain, you can just run it as if it's that.
So did the British send out a lot more colonialists to Canada after the war to support it, to populate it?
Yeah, I mean, based in Halifax. If you go to Halifax in Newfoundland, it's amazing. And this was for generations the biggest British naval base in the world, far bigger than any of the ones we maintained against the French. Now, we were absolutely determined to hold on to Canada. And they maintained this extraordinary stories of when they maintained a fleet on what they called the American Station throughout the bitter winters. This is the little ice age we're talking about here. And there are stories of, you know, men literally freezing to death and falling from the rigging as the British determinedly maintain this fleet off Halifax to make sure the Americans do not even think about trying to take Canada. Because again, a huge investment of money at the time, essentially just to protect prestige. No one then had any notion that one day, you know, in 100 years later, America would rule the world and so forth, or Canada would be huge and powerful. It was really a question of royal prestige.
The conditions in the British Navy seem to be absolutely appalling. Some of the stories of what happened in the Caribbean, you know, where the sailors weren't even allowed off the ships there in case they all ran off, and kept in appalling conditions on the ships and dying in their thousands of diseases and things. It was this still the era of the press gang?
Yeah, it was the year of rum, sodomy and the lash, as Shane McGowan would have said. You know, it was ferocious. But in many ways, you have to remember that, and this is, again, really important for the Georgians in England, it was not great to be a peasant in England.
Right.
You know, now, this is the era in which the peasantry of England are finally crushed. They are disappropriated of all their common land in this thing called enclosures, which we're kind of largely forgotten, except for people like Billy Bragg and the Levellers.
Yeah.
Talk about it still. You know, the English peasantry were the first in Europe to be totally, basically, made landless peasants. The reason that the Industrial Revolution took off in the later years of George's reign is because there were so many people in rural England who were so bloody hungry and desperate for any kind of work, because all the common land which they'd used to have a couple of cows,
yeah,
which made all the difference if you were a farm labourer, they're all gone. And there are accounts in the 1740s of, you know, bands of, you know, armed gentry who would otherwise be hunting on their horses, you know, riding roughshod over scores of peasants who were demonstrating against the enclosure of this common land and just flattening them. And this is one of the things in which, again, George is really lucky, George III, because he takes the throne right at the time when everything's kind of coming together for this kind of world power defining England. You've crushed your own peasantry. You've crushed the Scots finally in 1745. You've got the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy is now coming together as this thing, this cult of all-out attack. All is prepared for this kind of assault on world power that begins in 1759, just before George takes the throne, the great year of victories.
The so-called Annus Mirabilis.
When it really is quite astonishing, I mean, and Tom Pocock's written a fabulous book on this called The Real First World War, I think it's called, subtitled anyway.
The End of the 7 Years' War.
Yeah, Britain in 1759 is able to mount simultaneous strategic offences in Canada and in Southeast Asia in the same year. No power on earth before or since, except for the Americans in 1944, has been able to do something like that. So when George comes to power, England, Great Britain, is almost megalomaniac with a sense of its own success. And in the very year after he appears, the Industrial Revolution kicks off. The Duke of Bridgewater builds the Manchester Ship Canal, which is generally taken as the first mark of the Industrial Revolution. He builds it. He's a great landowner who'd been there for hundreds of years, but he builds a canal so that the coal under his land can get taken to Manchester. The price of coal drops by 50% in Manchester overnight of that, but he can shift much, much more of it. And suddenly the British have cracked it. The Industrial Revolution has cracked this weird thing called the Malthusian trap, which is that for all of human history before now, land has had to do two things. It's had to feed people and provide fuel. This is often the problem in Africa to this day. Now, the Industrial Revolution suddenly discovers, oh, all under the north of England, there's coal under the fields. So you can get the energy source out from there, but keep growing stuff. This is the great thing that cracks the industry. And it happens, and it starts the year after George takes power. So here's this guy who didn't expect to become king for a long time afterwards because his father died very young. And he takes power just when this behemoth of Georgian England is about to have this extraordinary series of victories, basically over France, over its great rival, for the next 60 years, really, which will end up with it being, by the end of George III's reign, it is, beyond any doubt, the greatest power on earth.
So this coal is being used for steam machinery.
Firstly, it's been used to heat homes. This is the weird thing about Georgian England. We look at Georgian architecture with all its chimneys. We remember that England was the only country in the world at this stage that was using coal on a mass scale for domestic heating. We had this huge advantage over every other country in Europe, which was lots and lots of really easily gettable coal. It's not very deep and it's good compared to most European countries. It's really easy to get at and good quality. And that was the vital thing. King coal was what really kicked off the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Because the first steam engines were actually used as pumps to drain mines, tin mines and coal mines, not as locomotion in their own right. They were just, because the mines were getting deeper and deeper because the coal was so expensive, water's coming in, you've got to find some way to pump the water out. So guess what? You invent a kind of boiler with a top on and then you start doing shit with it, which I don't understand with it. And eventually it sucks the water out of the mine. Don't ask me how, but it did it.
And this new technology drives other developments.
By the 1770s, we're building the very first iron bridges made of iron in the world. And that's a fantastic thing. I recommend all your viewers to go and see this. I was brought up near there, the Iron Bridge Gorge. It's extraordinary kind of classical style bridge built of solid iron, but built as though they're working in oak still, because no one had worked out, and it still stands because it was so madly over-engineered. No one had any idea how strong iron was. And people came at the time from all over the world to look at this thing, thinking, oh, and they all wrote their diaries saying, oh my God, we've finally done something better than the Romans. Because no one had yet. We just copied them.
And so this just grows and grows, I suppose, one thing leading to another.
The coal mines need pumps to pump the water out. So you start making better and better pumping machines. They require finer and finer boring techniques to bore the cylinders more and more cleanly.
Right.
That can then be used to bore cast iron guns, which no other European country could do. So John Wilkinson's cannon boring machine actually starts to give the British Navy a technological advance.
Before this point, the cannons would be cast.
They'd be bronze. A cast iron gun is actually much, much lighter than a bronze gun. So, and you can start mass producing them, which the British Navy does in a way which no one else could do. In fact, John Wilkinson's brother even exports this secretly to the French under the guise of pipes for France's sewage system. And no one really cared because private enterprise, you know what, why not? We were very, very keen. We were so keen on private enterprise in the 18th century in a way that no American Republican would even dare to be now. You know, they absolutely believed trade in slaves. Why not? It's free enterprise. You know, trade it, sell your cannons to the French. Why not? This is private property. You know, we were actually much more like really right-wing Americans in the Georgian period, really, you know. But what really fascinates me about this period is that for most of us, I think, the word Georgian means property. And you know, any estate agent in this country goes, whoopee, when you mention the word Georgian, they rub their hands because they know that every decent Englishman wants a bit of Georgian. It's hardwired into us. We've come to accept that this is somehow, you know, the quintessential English postcard architecture.
Yes.
Of course, it's not at all. It's nothing to do with that. It's all entirely imported. It's classical architecture. The whole fashion was, you know, it kicked off basically with a book published in 1727 called Vesuvius Britannicus, written in English and French, because the entire English upper class still spoke French fluently. They had to, you know. And from that day on, I mean, Georgian is, you actually think about it next time you, dear listener, go to a Georgian house, go to the next one next door. It's bloody identical. You know, they are identikit bling houses built by the nouveau riche of Georgian England, who were rich off the slave trade in the Industrial Revolution. And they all have one choice in architecture. You want Georgian, don't you? You're right. You want Georgian. Because guess what? It's the only one in town. So for 100 years, no one builds anything except Georgian. And it's all done by half a dozen architects or their kind of lower down copiers, all based on a few plans from Italy via France. And yet we've come to accept that this is somehow quintessentially English, where it's got nothing to do with any previous English tradition whatever. It's just a sign you're a rich Georgian.
Other countries don't seem to have built in the same style at the time.
No, it's because other countries didn't have a gigantic new class of rich oligarchs who all wanted exactly the same houses as their neighbours.
So it's come to be seen as very English.
Absolutely.
It came from Italy, but no one else was doing it.
It's one of the weird things about English society. You know, we've come to accept the fact that this is somehow naturally ours and something to do with us and something to do with Englishness.
Yeah, well, you know, you look at Bath, it's like, well, this is
I'm talking to you from Bath. Yeah.
Well, there we are.
And it was all built by speculators.
When did Bath become the sort of Bath we recognize?
So Queen Anne's visit kind of starts being fashionable, but the real Georgian thing is basically a couple of local builders to get together and say, we've got this lovely coloured stone here. It looks a bit like Rome. There's this classical fashion people are going for. And we've got some Roman baths here. So why don't we just speculatively throw up this thing called the Royal Crescent?
Mm.
And people will buy it, lease it off us and things originally, and then later on buy it. I mean, it's pure. It's just done by private enterprise speculation. They've read their equivalent to the Sunday Times Style magazine. They've second-guessed what the new rich want and where they want it. And they've whacked up a socking great private development, flats to sell them. And it works perfectly. It's incredible.
When we say Georgian, is that pretty much George III?
Yeah, basically.
Is that when solidifies?
Yeah.
And we kind of think, well, this is the ultimate civilised behaviour. They're living in these lovely houses with the lovely chimneys, and they've got their lovely wigs on and their outfits, and it's all very dainty. And, you know, we think of, I know it's a bit later, you know, the likes of Jane Austen or whatever, but, you know, it's built on the back of A, you know, you've got this massive peasantry who've been robbed of their land and are being forced into the navy or into factories or whatever, and we've got coal mines, and we've got the slave trade fueling it, and the slave trade fueling sort of cheap sugar, tobacco, coffee stuff to keep the workers going. It's that huge mismatch. And of course we look back and most people tend to see the nice frocks and the nice houses and not think about the other stuff. And that seems to be at the heart of what the ructions in, like, the National Trust are all about. Is some people saying, no, we don't want to think about all that other stuff. We just want to see the nice paintings and the nice houses.
Exactly. And it behoves us well, I think, to think that for me, I certainly, not about you, but probably most of your listeners, would not have been let past the gate lodge of these places were it not for progressive death tax. After the Second World War, you know, they're not opening their houses out of the goodness of their hearts. They gave them all to the National Trust so they could stay living in them. And, you know, these were built as repositories of wealth, to show off your wealth. You had your Gainsborough view over your fireplace. You had your vases from China to show you'd got stuff. You had treasures of India wrapped up around you, and probably your money came from coal or the slave trade, and you pretend that it didn't. This was the great trick of the English aristocracy, to pretend they were just... I mean, the English aristocracy essentially were the wealthiest in Europe throughout the 18th and 19th century because of mineral extraction, because the laws in England are different. In France or Germany, it all belongs to the state. By a sheer fluke of weird post-conquest law, basically, the English aristocracy retained the mineral rights to their land, which would have been in the crown's property in France or Germany. And that's why they're also rich, essentially. That's why land matters so much, because you get in England, you get not just the land, but everything underneath it.
Right. But in other countries, that all belongs to...
It belongs to the crown or the state or whatever you call it.
Did that change in the rest of Europe?
No, it's pretty much the same. But the reason for it is just a legal one. It's that English landowners were bigger and wealthier. Ultimately, because of the conquest and because of enclosures and so forth, also because in England you had single line inheritance. Mm. So it all goes to the oldest son. Now in Germany or France, Spain, it goes to all the different sons. You end up with little patchworks of estates. And so no one's quite sure what exactly is underneath whose land. It's a simple legal thing. It got so complicated that the French crown, followed by the German princes, all said, look, we've got to get this coal out. We can't go through endless lawsuits. It all belongs to us. End of. Whereas in Britain, the land holdings were big enough so you knew damn well whose land it was. Simple technical thing about the law and land ownership. Of course, that was another thing that made the Royal Navy and the British Army so effective in the 18th century, is that if you're the younger son of an earl or just a gentry man, you're going to inherit nothing.
Mm.
All you've got is your good name. Now, that will get you a good position in the army, provided you've got the money to pay for it, but it'll get you interest, backing, as they called it, interest, they called it in the 18th century. But it won't get you. You're never going to inherit the house, unlike your French or Spanish counterpart, who will be one day. All their sons will be the dukes of so and so. All their sons will get something. So Britain has this class of people who are brought up to be part of the gentry, but have no prospect of ever getting any real money.
Is that partly what drives the conquest of India? The chance that you can go over there and take some land. I mean, you can even become a local ruler.
Yeah, if you belong to a class or a castry like that, you will do anything for money. got your good name, your father's good name, you are the younger brother of the Right Honourable so-and-so. You've got to get money somehow, you know? What else are you going to do? You're not going to become middle class. Ah, horror. You know, you're going to get a job? No way. You're going to conquer somewhere. So these younger sons, they charge into the Navy and the Army, and they're prepared to storm the bastions of Badajoz or fight overwhelming odds in the Navy because they don't care. They used to toast in the Navy. The toast was in the wardroom, the lieutenant's dining room. The toast was a good war and a sickly season because they knew that only one in six of them would ever make it to captain. So the more of them died, the better. So you had this, this extraordinary mix. You've got the money for the Industrial Revolution and this really militaristic, gung-ho army and navy manned by young men of the officer class with nothing to lose. Mm. And every army, you know, every general you speak to knows that's the boys you want as your first lieutenants. The posh young guys with absolutely nothing to lose, you know.
And the other thing driving India, was there a feeling that we've lost America? We're not going to put armies over there and put our efforts over there, but India is up for grabs now.
Yes, I don't think it's a conscious government policy at first, because at this stage, India's still being run by in a kind of weird semi-private enterprise base by the nabobs like Clive of India, who are just basically robber barons, who would just strip the place and also marry Indian women without thinking about it. No, that's no trouble. They're all posh. Why not? You know. So, they're having this extraordinary free-for-all there. But yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, Britain at least has the sense to realise there's no point fighting it out with the Americans. Well, apart from burning Washington in 1812. But that's just revenge, you know. Basically, that's a done deal. We're not going to get them back. So let's absolutely make sure they don't get Canada.
Yeah.
And let's switch our attention towards east of Suez. It's a really interesting time, like, very complicated, but these sort of 1770s, the loss of America, the gaining of India, the rise of Prussia, it's fascinating stuff.
It is. And there's so much we could talk about. They're going to get a whole series out of this. I think we will leave it there for now. Thank you so much, James. That was absolutely fascinating.
It's a pleasure as ever.
And good luck. You're currently working on your next shortest history, which is Shortest History of Ireland.
Yep. My wife is Irish, and I did used to work there in my younger days. And I started my academic career there. I have a great fondness for it. And I went through as a kind of labour of love. It's a lot of work because you've got to go down and start looking at the ancient Irish annals in the original sometimes just to check things out, which is fascinating. So I'm just about up to the Act of Union now. So it's kind of plain sailing. I've got over the stony ground of Cromwell and things like that. So.
And all when is that due for publication?
As soon as I can finish it, my publisher's champing at the bit somewhat.
Well, theoretically, this series will last for eternity. It'll always be there. So someone could be listening to this in the year 3000, remembering, oh, yes, Shortest History of Ireland, the biggest selling book of the 21st
century. The one that got him executed.
Well, good luck with finishing it. And thank you so much for finding the time to come and educate me.
Pleasure as ever.
Cheers, James. So that was James Hawes, author of the wonderful Shortest History of Germany and the even more wonderful Shortest History of England. Now, I've talked about that book before, but really, if you want one book to cover all this stuff that I've been talking about in the series, that's the one to go for. And make sure you come back for the second part of George III's life in the next episode, where my special guest will be Ian Hislop. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.